Yes, hello. I'm Jason Louv. This is the Ultra Culture Podcast, and my guest today is the British journalist George Pendle, who's the author of the book Strange Angel, The Otherworldly Life of Rocket Scientist Jack Parsons, which is, of course, the source material for the TV show Strange Angel, which is currently running on CBS All Access. So Strange Angel is the story of one of my absolute heroes, John Whiteside Parsons, also known as Jack Parsons, who was a rocket scientist who lived in Pasadena, California, in the United States in the first half of the 20th century. He actually invented solid-state rocket fuel, which was responsible for putting America on the moon, as well as fueling the nuclear ICBM missiles that made up its arsenal in the Cold War. Now, that was only Jack's day job. He spent his nights practicing sexual magic as a member of Aleister Crowley's Ordo Templi Orientis and collecting a group of bohemians, anarchists, and science fiction writers and other ne'er-do-wells around him at his mansion in Pasadena, which he dubbed the Parsonage, which would be the site for some legendary exploits, some of which we'll get into in this show. It's really exciting seeing Jack finally get his day in the spotlight with the release of the TV show Strange Angel, because I really think that he's one of the most larger-than-life and also most important characters in American history, and absolutely in the history of both science and magic. I really feel that Jack embodies the Promethean instinct of humanity, the side that's just not satisfied with the way things are and wants to push forward beyond all horizons, beyond all limits. And that's a spirit that I try to live by as much as I can in my life. So who better to talk about Jack, his legacy, and what he has to say to the 21st century than George Pendle, the man himself. So strap in, because we had a great conversation and you're really, really going to enjoy it. Oh, and by the way, Jack is also one of the subjects of my new book, John Dee and the Empire of Angels, Enochian Magic and the Occult Roots of the Modern World, which really puts Parsons' occult work in its proper context for, I think, the first time, showing how it's part of a clear continuum of magical work begun by John Dee and Edward Kelly in 16th century England, taken up again by Aleister Crowley at the beginning of the 20th century, and then passed on to Parsons, who really, in my opinion, crystallized the entire occult tradition in its form best suited for the modern world. Parsons, of course, was a devoted practitioner of Enochian magic, the occult system first formulated by John Dee, Queen Elizabeth I's scientific advisor, a man who, like Parsons, was both a scientist and a magician, and who was responsible for kickstarting England's naval program and exploration of the New World, just like Parsons, almost 400 years later, would be responsible for initiating the United States space program and exploration of other planets. It's fascinating to compare these two men, separated by a distance of centuries, using both science and magic to expand the boundaries of the human experience as much as possible, both into outer space and inner space. John Dee and the Empire of Angels is available now on Amazon or wherever books are sold. You can also find it at johndee007.com, johndee007.com. All right, with no further ado, here's George. George, thank you so much for being on the show. How's it going?
Good, thanks. Thank you for having me.
Of course. I've been a huge fan of your book, Strange Angel, since it came out. It really was the and is the definitive book on Jack Parsons. And now, of course, it's been adapted into a TV show, which is running on CBS All Access.
That's right.
Have you been able to catch the show? And what do you think about it, especially compared to the book?
Yeah, no, I have been watching it. And, you know, I have mixed emotions. I'm not really heavily involved in the TV show at all. So it's as much as of a surprise to me as it would be to anybody else. But you know, I'm I think they're doing a really good job. I know, I've just from following online, I know some people have really reacted strongly against it, and some people have said they like it a lot. But, you know, I'm probably the ideal audience for it, obviously. But I think they've taken, you know, what is basically Parsons' life, and they've been pretty faithful to it. Admittedly, they've condensed a few characters. They've kind of, you know, kind of extended a few bits of plot this way and that. They've created a few new people. But I think the spirit of the whole TV show is very much in keeping with how I imagine, you know, Parsons to be. I mean, it's still early stages yet. The TV show is still just dealing with Parsons' early work on rocketry and his first dabblings in the occult. It hasn't got much further. But you know, I'm optimistic. They're taking it at a kind of like slow and steady pace, or rather like one of, you know, kind of Parsons' kind of rocket fuels. They want it to kind of burn steadily towards what I hope will be a kind of, you know, explosion later on. So, you know, I'm enjoying it.
I am too. I have to say my favorite part, I've only caught the first episode so far, so I have a little bit to catch up on, but I have to say my favorite part is how they show his perceptions of the world where, mm-hmm. like, without giving too much away, where he kind of lapses into, he's viewing the world like a science fiction book, which, mm-hmm. I think is just beautiful. It captures the spirit of Parsons in a way. And
but yeah, I think that that's, you know, using those visuals as a way of expressing kind of Parsons' own kind of imaginative side, which was so powerful, is really a great way of doing it, kind of lapsing into these fantasy sequences.
I'm kind of amazed the show got made at all for the specific reason of the involvement of Scientology. And I know I know that when Going Clear came out, I think I read online that HBO had a team of 100 lawyers working for a year to bulletproof the show, and that's HBO. It's unbelievable. So I can't slight them for adding some composite characters in there, unless they get that story in later on. I mean, I don't know.
From what I understand, I mean, I spoke to the guy Mark Heyman, who's kind of turned it into a TV show, turned the book into a TV show, and he says that what they have planned are 5 seasons of 10 episodes each. So Hubbard probably won't arrive if they're doing it chronologically, until the second season probably, but they fully intend on using him, he told me. So their lawyers have cleared it there. So I think what we're seeing is Scientology. When I wrote the book, I was definitely, I mean, the lawyers at the publishing house went crazy over it. But it seems that, touch wood, Scientology has become a little less litigious than it used to be. I think they have bigger fish to fry, perhaps. You know, they're just more of a full-on trying to become a normal organization.
Well, they caught so much flack from that documentary. And, you know, I live in LA, so I get to kind of see this firsthand. And it doesn't, you know, in a lot of ways, Scientology definitely seems to put up a bigger front than what they actually are. I don't think there's really that many people left in it, to be honest.
Yeah, well, it would be interesting to know the exact numbers. Yeah, I haven't really, you know, kept up on the latest in Scientology other than, you know, Going Clear and so on. But it's, I mean, I'm hoping that they're less litigious. Right. Otherwise, the TV show doesn't stand a chance.
Well, let's back up. I mean, because I want to talk about what's going on now, but we should start off for, you know, the people who don't know the backstory here. Maybe just walk us through who Jack Parsons was. You know, he was many different people at the same time, but who was Jack Parsons, and why is he so resonant in the modern world?
Yeah, well, Jack Parsons was this kind of very interesting figure in the 1930s, 1940s. He was born in 1914. And he was, a young guy growing up in 20s America in California, in Pasadena. And through reading science fiction magazines and books, he became absolutely kind of driven towards building a rocket that would get man off the earth and, as he hoped, to the moon. Now, this was incredibly difficult because at the time rocketry wasn't even a science. In fact, you know, the whole idea of a rocket was seen as purely for the realms of science fiction. It was for kids, it was for dreams, it was for madmen. You know, the scientific establishment didn't start teaching rocketry, you know, until well into the 1940s. But here was Parsons in the 1930s, like as a late teenager in his early 20s, trying to build a rocket that would work in like his backyard with a couple of, you know, close friends who were also kind of fueled by the stories of science fiction. And slowly but surely, through their kind of enthusiasm for all this, they managed to get the scientific establishment to pay attention to the fact that rockets could be the next big thing. And yet at the same time, as well as kind of, you know, working in the world of science and trying to push forward, you know, into this new space age, he was also tremendously interested in the occult and with the teachings of Aleister Crowley. And so kind of by day, he was kind of building rockets for what would become the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. By night, he was immersing himself in Crowley's teachings and slowly kind of worked his way up the hierarchy of the Ordo Templi Orientis in Los Angeles until he was really in charge of the entire lodge there. And so you had this kind of what was fascinating for me is that, you know, you had this person who's interested in science and magic, which, you know, to most people would seem to be opposites. Yet for Parsons, and, you know, I think it's quite a real kind of conjunction there. For Parsons, he saw them as two sides of the same coin. They were both very much this kind of this way of trying to escape the earth, trying to free oneself from mankind's condition. To him, they were closely related, and they were both, you know, really very scientific in the way that he saw them, scientific ways of improving man, of forcing man to the next level of evolution. And so, you know, Parsons lived this kind of weirdly kind of segmented life, which slowly the two sides leached together. And so he could be found chanting Crowley's, you know, hymn to Pan at rocket launches, or inviting kind of members of the Manhattan Project to come and join in with the occult rituals at his house in Pasadena. And so you had these two worlds kind of meshing until it all kind of fell apart in basically the post-war years. He was investigated by the FBI. He was accused of being a communist. He was accused of being, you know, some kind of pervert. The rocketry, the scientific establishment that had eventually embraced him, threw him out. The OTO was kind of dissipated, or rather it dissolved. And he was left kind of by himself, kind of trying to create his own form of magic, working odd jobs for various aerospace companies, until at the age of 37, he died in an explosion in his home laboratory. And, you know, some people say, was it suicide? Some people say, was it murder? Or was it just an accident? That's how he left us, with lots of questions, not too many answers, but with a very fascinating story.
It's amazing how, in a way, he really seems to embody... He just seems to embody the kind of Faustian driver, that the need to be more. And, you know, the combination of science fiction, magic, rocketry, it seems strange on the surface, but then you just think about it. It's like, of course, that's what a really gifted, smart young guy at the time would have been interested in. I sometimes wonder what Parsons would have made of the internet, you know, because now we can kind of get, we can research all this fascinating stuff on the internet. But I imagine growing up in Pasadena, in between the two wars, it must have been so boring. So for somebody like that to, I mean, of course he would be interested in all that, but for it's such a fascinating conjunction of things, like you say. But I feel like maybe this is the time for Parsons to get more recognition, because it seems to make much more sense to people now for some reason.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, when I first wrote the book, I mean, this, you know, when I was writing the book back in 2002, 2003, I mean, you know, people had written about Parsons a little bit, but it was very much kind of confined to the shadows, I feel like. And the whole idea of me writing the book was to try and get as much actual fact as I could in a very kind of pretty much journalistic way, you know, going for sources, going for primary sources, speaking to people who had known him, and patching it all together. Because I think he is such an interesting character that you want to kind of get rid of all the hearsay, because the reality is crazy enough. And I think I think now it feels like people are interested, not only because he kind of, you know, he had this kind of willingness to defy probability, and he has that kind of heroic, you know, appeal of a guy who everybody says, you can't do this, and he says, yes, I can. But I think, you know, in a ways he kind of symbolized a kind of age of freedom and exploration, whether in rocketry or in occultism, which kind of slowly became consolidated into kind of systems of control. In the post-war years, like, you know, the military-industrial complex took over his work on rocketry, which was very much a kind of individualistic pursuit for him. And you know, corporate cults like Scientology kind of took over a lot of the occultism, which he had been working on, or at least kind of took various parts of it and used it for themselves. And so, you know, I think Parsons does hold the kind of, in one way, he stands for something which is much harder to do now, which is kind of be your own man amidst all these giant kind of, you know, against all these forces pressing against you. I mean, I don't know if you, certainly your program, you have such interesting speakers on. It seems there's a growing interest in, you know, if you just take something like psychedelics for medicinal and therapeutic purposes, people are realizing that the mind can't be served entirely by modern science, by rational thought.
Absolutely. Because we've got to this point where we have the most advanced technology of human history and people are still miserable. So
right, exactly.
trying to figure it all out.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of people are looking down different paths. And I think that's, you know, part of me regrets having written the book. You know, I wrote it when I was in my late 20s. I'm now like in my early 40s. And I wish I had a bit more of the kind of, you know, of maturity when I wrote it. It's not that I don't think it's a good book. It's just that I think I was a little scared of embracing Parsons' magical side too much. I wanted to keep a journalistic objectivity, and I'm glad I did. But I don't think the reality of it, I was very worried about treating magic as something which, you know, is it real or is it not? And I, you know, deep in my heart of hearts when I was writing it, I didn't think it was real. And now I realize that's not the point. You know, it's about the relevance rather than the reality. And for Parsons, it was entirely relevant.
Sure. Yeah, my take on magic is it's completely about subjectivity. It's about how people craft their subjective experience of the world.
Right, exactly. Yeah, very much so. And I don't think I quite have that grasp, although I don't think it impinges on the book that much. No. But in my heart of hearts, I wish I had had that feeling when I wrote it. So that's why I think Parsons is kind of why more people why CBS of all people are willing to push it forward, because we are at the stage now where everybody's looking for, you know, for different options, you know, right. You know, different ways of looking at things. And Parsons definitely gives you a different way of looking at things.
Well, I have to say, of course, you know, as you're saying, Parsons has been this legendary occult figure for so long, and just to know about Parsons kind of put you in a cognoscenti. And the question when you, as I'm sure you did, when you first discovered this guy, the immediate question is how does nobody know about this person? This is the most improbable individual. It must be the most improbable individual of the 20th century. But I have to say, so it must be 3 or 4 weeks ago now, right before the show was about to come out, I walked outside of my front door in Los Angeles and a city bus drove by with a picture of Parsons on the side, and it had the slogan sex, magic, rocket science. And it was just this cosmic joke moment. I was just thinking, what timeline are we in? But I realized that, you know, one conclusion that I came to is when the Soviet Union fell, there was total interest in, people became totally interested in magic and the occult and psychic phenomena. And I've met so many people who grew up in the Eastern Bloc countries after the fall of the wall, and they're all, you know, unironically 1000% interested in this and take it very, very seriously. And the conclusion that I came to is it must be something that people go to when they feel insecure, when the other structures are falling apart and they need something stable to stand on. And so I think the same thing is happening in America now. So I don't think it's any mistake that suddenly people are looking to things like that, because they need something more. You know, they kind of have to look to something more eternal to get their stability instead of what they're seeing around them.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair enough. And I think actually that happened in Parsons' life itself. I mean, when he was kind of thrown out of the scientific, you know, establishment, when he could no longer build rockets because his security clearance was taken away, he found solace in his magic. And that's when he threw himself into his, you know, his most complex magical workings. It was then that's where he found, you know, sense for himself, or where he found succor. I think that's absolutely right. I think, although it does make me worried about, you know, what is coming. If people, you know, if the Soviet Union, your analogy of the Soviet Union is is to be true, what's going to happen to the US and the Western world?
Well, we get to find out.
Yeah, exactly. Front row seat.
But yeah, so one thing that I think your book really brought out really well, because I love Sex and Rockets also, and I actually used to work for Feral House. And
oh, did you? Right.
Rest in peace to Adam Parfrey, very sadly. But he, obviously the first book that came out, Sex and Rockets, is very much the glamour, the sensationalized version of the story. And it's a great book, but yours, as you said, really takes the journalistic much more precision to it. And one thing that I think that comes out very clearly in your book that is not in the mythology of Parsons is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that his downfall was not magic. I mean, people always are quick to say, oh, well, if you dabble in the dark arts, this is the end that you come to. But looking at his biography objectively and looking at your book, it seems pretty clear that his real problem was that he was naive enough to go to Communist Party meetings, and then he just developed a really nasty drug habit, and that doesn't seem to have done him any favors. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, the Communist Party thing is interesting. It's not the 1930s, you know, like fascism is sweeping across Europe. You're like a 19, 20 year old, you know, your friends are at university. Who hasn't, you know, gone to a weird meeting when you're 19 or 20 years old, you know, and it just so happened that Parsons happened to go to meetings whereby future communists were members of. And so I think he went to them in a kind of, you know, just kind of new idea. I want to see new ideas. I want to hear them. I don't think he was particularly interested. But yeah, I think that did eventually kind of tar him with a kind of communist brush in the post-war years. I mean, I think, you know, his major failing was that he relied on kind of father figures too much. He put his trust in people who did not, you know, deserve his trust. And that, you know, this absolute faith in people being genuine, like you say, he's got this kind of naive belief he had, not just in, you know, in communism, whatever, but in people was probably his biggest downfall. I think he was a romantic in the truest sense of the world, in that he believed in people being their best. And unfortunately, they weren't in real life. He constantly wanted to live in a kind of fictional world. Yeah, added to the drugs, you know, you don't end up with a terribly good situation. I mean, I think a lot of people see like his because he really got into his magic after his kind of major you know, successes in rocketry, people do see it as a kind of slippery downslope. But I think that was how he was really shoring himself up using his magic. That was all that was left for him. So it wasn't really the cause of his ultimate, you know, breakdown and death, but it was a way that he was using of kind of stopping himself from crashing and burning, so to speak.
Right. Giving some type of structure to his,
yeah, to his existence. Life. I think that's it. Yeah.
Which it's great for, you know.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, so. Well, what do you have? Maybe this is too hot of a question, but I'm curious if you, after having done this book and in the years since, what are your thoughts on his demise? I mean, do you have any, if you had to make your best guess, what do you think happened there?
Yeah, well, I'm going to give a very boring answer because I often found just from being a journalist that the boring answers are often the best answer.
Right.
And it's a kind of Occam's razor thing. You know, basically there are three different camps who have different theories around Parsons' death. And you have the camp who believe he was depressed and this was a suicide attempt, which I don't think anybody would try and blow themselves up in a suicide. I just don't, it seems too arcane. Now other people say, you know, it was a magical ritual gone wrong, and that could be, but I still don't see why he was using various explosive materials. And he used a lot of materials in his magic rituals, but never kind of, you know, fulminate of mercury. And I think the most obvious thing is that, you know, he was a guy who throughout his life had just had this, you know, he had been absolutely cavalier with explosives, with chemicals. I mean, that was his brilliance. He could, you know, I think I say in the book, he kind of could conduct an explosion like a symphony. He knew what to add to give it like a fuller power at the start or at the end or in the middle, you know, but he was cavalier. He used to mix stuff in coffee cans. He used to keep TNT in the back of his car. You know, everybody talks about these. And I think it makes more sense that, you know, he was rushing to mix up a batch of chemicals for one of these odd jobs he was doing towards the end of his life for a special effects company in Hollywood. And he was whipping up some chemicals. He was about to go on holiday with his wife. And he just, you know, basically it caught up with him, you know, his sloppy way of working, his kind of crazy seat of the pants working just eventually caught up with him, and he just dropped his chemicals and he exploded. You know, other people say Howard Hughes assassinated him. I just don't see it. He did work for Howard Hughes's company, but I think that's, you know, that's pretty
far. About the LAPD thing where he had testified against an ex-LAPD officer in an explosives case, and there was the idea that there was some type of revenge there?
Yeah, no, that is definitely more compelling. That's probably the most compelling, that this was somehow involved in his testimony against Earl Kinnett, who was, a high-ranking police officer who had, been convicted for car-bombing somebody. But still, I think Kinnett had actually come out of prison like maybe a year before, 6 months before. But still, I think Parsons would have been a strange figure to go after in revenge rather than the prosecutor or Clifford, I forgot his first name, Clifford, who was one of these pioneering anti-corruption people. And Parsons' testimony was extremely valuable in getting him to prison, but why go after the scientific advisor rather than like somebody else, you know, one of the major players in the case?
Got it. Well, one detail that's in your book, I remember right after your book came out, I was working at the publishing company Disinformation in New York as the book's editor. And I remember I had a conversation with Richard Metzger where he pointed out that there's a detail in your book where you mentioned that his hands were always sweating, like Ed Foreman or somebody like that had observed that he was always sweating. And he was saying, well, you know, that kind of sounds like he was on speed and may have even been making his own speed. And I think it's either your book or Sex and Rockets. There's a detail that there was a used syringe of morphine found at the scene also. So it's a potential and very unglamorous conclusion that he was just, you know, trying to do a rush job and he was on speed while handling chemicals, or speed and morphine.
I think that's it. I mean, you know, I there was definite drug use going on. The guy where I think that comes from, it's a guy called Greg Gansey, who lived upstairs from him, where, you know, was in the building when he exploded it at his death. And he said that he found syringes, you know, in the trash can. And he wanted to get rid of them, you know, before the police came. So he got rid of them, you know, when they rushed down to try and help Parsons. Now, the problem is, like, syringes can also be used in chemical experiments. Were they actually drug syringes or not? Definitely Parsons was using all sorts of stuff throughout his life. Whether he was using it that day, you know, like I said, I tried in my book to get absolutely everything concrete. And what I couldn't, I put up there with a cautionary kind of, you know, inverted commas around it. But definitely he was using drugs throughout his life. And it could well be that he was on, you know, speed or something while he was making it. I mean, it was a rush job, he said. So, you know, maybe he was just, getting a little help to finish it on time.
Got it. Well, that seems to, for me, that's the explanation that's the least glamorous and makes the most sense, you know. But let me ask you this also. For somebody like that, who was that brilliant and mercurial in the true sense, who do you think Parsons would have become if he had lived?
I mean, it's really tricky to kind of think about that, because, you know, a lot of his other, you know, the guys who are part of the Suicide Squad, you know, who were basically the Suicide Squad with the early Rocketeers in America, they were all kind of, you know, they were expelled. Like, they were the Chinese student was sent back to China. Frank Molina, one of his best friends and rocketry engineers, was sent into exile in France. Like, whether he'd be part of the scientific world is not known. I think maybe he would have subsided into a kind of Californian LA kind of counterculture, I think, until the 60s really revived him, you know, until the hippie area. I mean, a lot of people, when you read Parsons' writing, it's often uncanny in the way that it predicts, you know, basically the coming 60s. You know, I think in the Book of Babylon, which was his grand magical working, you know, he says that he wants to usher in this age of love and understanding and Dionysian freedom. And you're just like, hold on, you were just 20 years too early. That's the problem. So if he had survived, would he have kind of just mingled along with, you know, his wife, Marjorie Cameron, in a kind of, you know, in that the Ferris art gallery kind of crowd in LA? until his thoughts and writings were once again kind of revived in the 60s. Possibly. I mean, would he have been there with Timothy Leary? I don't know. Maybe. It's kind of hard to see him because he so brilliantly defined his time and his place and all the, you know, excesses and brilliances of the 40s and 30s and early 50s. It's kind of hard to see him, how he would have progressed. I think he would have been, maybe his face would have been on Sergeant Pepper rather than, you know, Alison Krauss. I don't know, maybe.
Well, maybe it's just taken this long for the rest of us to catch up with him, because it seems that now in 2018, it's, you know, now we have people like Elon Musk running around and people are very interested in magic. Suddenly it's like the zeitgeist seems to have come around to where Parsons was in the 1940s, which what a testament to the guy, right? How can somebody be that far ahead of his time?
I think that's absolutely right. When you do look at, his way of operating, which was, you know, really seen as, you know, weird and strange, both scientifically and magically, is now seen as kind of great entrepreneurship. You know, it's the one guy going ahead with his crazy idea of building electric cars, like, is now, you know, the Tony Stark figure. You know, it's now seen as like being very much a kind of an archetype, which but passed so long before, you know.
Well, I had actually heard, I'm not sure if this is true or not, but I hope it's true. I heard that in several of the Marvel movies, they have Tony Stark's father appears, who was an inventor in the 40s, and he looks exactly like Jack Parsons. And I had heard that they had based him on Parsons. So I don't know if you've heard anything about that. But.
I have. I mean, you know, it's, I know the mustache is definitely, there's a Tony Stark link there between the mustaches. I hadn't heard that. It's a great idea because, you know, it would work very well. But yeah, there's definitely that kind of link between, you know, individuals, great scientific individuals working by themselves. Marvel, of course, was his real name. So it was his first name. So
that's
a great Marvel link there.
that's hilarious. Well, let's talk about the bohemian side of Parsons, because one thing that's been coming much more to light in the last few years is the time he spent with Marjorie Cameron. There was, of course, that big exhibition at MoCA in Los Angeles, and then it was in New York, which I'm guessing you hopefully got to see of all of Marjorie Cameron's artwork. And they had Parsons, the wrapper of his ashes and his magical dagger and his birth chart there, along with all of Cameron's art. And something that there was also a book put out, there were a couple books put out along with the show that had a bunch of Parsons' unpublished poetry side by side with Cameron's artwork. And
yes. I wrote an essay for that.
Great. Okay.
I was well within it. Yeah.
What beautiful stuff, right? I mean, that was like a whole side of, because there's so little published material left from Parsons. It was like this whole new side emerging. So I'm curious if you could talk to Cameron's role, and then as they kind of recast themselves as kind of beatniks, or proto beatniks, and edged into the early California counterculture.
Yeah, well, first of all, the Parsons Cameron Foundation, which basically has kept Marjorie Cameron's work alive, and kept it from being lost or disappearing. Has done such a great job of reviving her story, because she really has a great kind of role in post-war LA and the occult scene. And those shows were fantastic. She's a very interesting individual. I kind of feel, for those who don't know the story, Parsons was head of the OTO in Los Angeles, in Pasadena, and he had lost his girlfriend, who happened to be his wife's sister, to a new member of the cult, who was L. Ron Hubbard. He was very angry, and he decided that he would conjure an elemental to replace his girlfriend. And the result of this magical working was Marjorie Cameron, or at least Parsons thought so. And she was this very strident individual who kind of swept into Parsons' life, like a force of nature, and basically became kind of intrinsically bound with Parsons in the last few years of his life. I mean, she was, she had been working as an illustrator, but she kind of created this kind of wonderful mid-century kind of gothic, magical art based around Parsons and Parsons' poetry and Parsons himself. There's this, you know, a wonderful picture of him painted as like the angel of death with giant wings and a robe and so on. But the two of them kind of, it was almost like this one could almost believe that she really was an elemental, because she was this ferocious woman who kind of spurred Parsons on to greater and greater magical heights, yet also would kind of, you know, didn't heed anything he said, was kind of absolutely, you know, willing to go her own way, wasn't going to be trapped by one guy. And she kind of had this, you know, she carried on his flame after his death. She, you know, you might have seen her in Kenneth Anger's inauguration of the Pleasure Dome. She pops up in a lot of strange places in the contemporary art world, in the occult world. And she kind of just kept, you know, Parsons' flame kind of just about, you know, burning there while many people had really forgotten about him. I mean, it wasn't really until, I mean, what was it, the mid-1990s that I feel like people started going again. Of course, Sex and Rockets came out, which was really good in kind of stilling a lot of the hearsay together in one volume.
Well, I think there was an essay about him in Apocalypse Culture, the first Apocalypse Culture in the 80s, and that's how I found out about him, at least.
Right, yeah, that was it. But really, for like, you know, 30 years, he was forgotten. You know, he was, you know, when I first started looking for him, before I found Sex and Rockets, which, you know, I didn't find it for like the first 6 months or so that I was researching the book. Such were the early internet days. When I first looked for him, I was looking in like books, and all I could find were like footnotes about him, or, you know, really I got to know about him through writing a feature for an art magazine on Kenneth Anger's films. And it was really through Marjorie Cameron that I found Parsons.
Yeah, people forget how hard it was to get information about this stuff. It was almost impossible, which made it all the more tantalizing in a way and important,
right,
when you
exactly.
got it. It was like hunting for rare 12 inches or something like that.
You know, exactly. I mean, you know, there was no, I look at the Wikipedia page now on Parsons, I'm like, wow, you know, this would have been helpful. Yeah, a lot of it's based on my book, but there was nothing on Parsons online really at all. You know, there were just a few people who had kept the fires burning. One was Cameron and her, you know, friend Scott Hobbs, who runs the Cameron Parsons Foundation. The other was a great documentary filmmaker called Susan Pyle, who had been tracking down lots of Jack's old friends from the early 90s, and she was making a documentary on Parsons, which unfortunately has yet to see, you know, to be displayed, but should be, because she has just a wealth of knowledge on him. And, you know, there was the OTO who had, you know, basically kept his papers and had kept, you know, knowledge of him, you know, being spread around, but it was small little pockets, you know, around the world. There wasn't really much else.
Well, I want to circle back a bit to his relationship with Cameron, because it seems to me that was the relationship of his life, and so much of his life as a fully grown individual and a magician and a thinker just revolved around her. And I find that relationship fascinating for a lot of reasons, especially as we get more clear on it, as that Spencer Cansa biography was written, and some of this show and some of the exhibit. And I don't feel that Cameron has gotten her full due yet. Someone should write the definitive book on Cameron. But she, it's fascinating when we look, because you were talking about Parsons' naive trust of father figures. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, lost his father at a young age, and he lived in this fantasy world of, you know, rockets and magic. And of course, he would, you know, do magic to get a girlfriend and this type of thing. But their relationship, you know, the whole conjuring of a scarlet woman, this is such a male power fantasy in a way. And we see this with younger guys who get into magic now. But
their
relationship is fascinating, because Cameron, I feel like he was kind of a boy. He writes about this also in his analysis by Master of the Temple, where he was like a little boy until he met Cameron. And he writes about her basically not giving him any slack and not allowing him to be childish and dependent.
Yeah.
And she seems to have been kind of a caustic influence on him in a way, or a sobering or maturing influence. Although I think there was also the FBI notes where they said that they thought that she had ruined him also, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, no, you'll have to excuse me if I don't have all the facts. As I said, it's been a while since I wrote the book, but no, there was definitely some of that. I mean, Parsons had this you know, this fascination with the feminine throughout his life. And you can see it in his writings. You can see it just in his general, you know, relationships with women. I mean, on the one hand, he had this, you know, he had a very intensely close relationship with his mother, you know, who committed suicide 6 hours after Parsons died. You know, he had this, you know, some would say an obsessive quest for sex, but then you could say that pretty much about any young guy. I mean, you said Cameron turned him from a young man into a mature man.
And, or tried to.
Yeah, tried to. But you, I mean, you have to remember, he was a young man. I mean, Parsons, when he had built rockets for the government, when he had, you know, ascended to the head of the OTO, he was, what was he? He was 31. You know, he was 30. You know, he was, you know, by the end of the war, when he was at his peak, he was barely out of his 20s. He was still trying to create, you know, form himself, I think. And I think, but he really did see like a link to the feminine. There was, you know, his fascination with Cameron kind of combined it, because there was this wish to kind of conquer women and to submit to them at the same time. You know, there were definitely hints from the people I spoke to when I was writing the book that he had had, you know, gay experiences, that he was, you know, he swung both ways, he was bisexual, what was he? And so I think there's definitely some, you know, I'm sorry to kind of mix everything up together, but, you know, towards the end of his life, he wrote, I think, a tract on witchcraft. This was his new religion he was planning, called the witchcraft. And this had a very strong feminine idea, along with the Book of Babylon, which was all about a female figure bringing in the new age. And I think, even though a lot of his attitudes were very kind of, you know, 1940s man, if you can imagine, I think he was weirdly forward-looking in his interest in the feminine. I mean, do you think that too?
Yeah, I absolutely think that. I think you can make the same point about Crowley also, although Crowley was even more moribundly stuck in kind of 19th century colonial attitudes about just about everything. Mm-hmm. But reading, there's, you know, what I think that Parsons wrote very little, but what he wrote is almost pristinely clear. And yeah, that essay on the witchcraft, the essay on all the stuff about Babylon. I mean, you read that stuff with the benefit of hindsight, and he's talking about feminism in the 60s. He's talking about the birth of the feminist witchcraft movement, the goddess movement. This is all stuff that happened. You know, people had not yet burned their bras yet. This is the 40s he's writing this in. So it's unbelievable. And I think it's testament to, I mean, whether you believe in magic or not, I think it's testament that he was you could at least say that he was tapped into the social currents at a really, really deep level, that he was really picking up on things that wouldn't fully come to prominence for another couple decades, or maybe even until now. And it's fascinating for me to look at how our attitudes about Parsons have changed over time also. And Crowley, particularly now, the women's witchcraft movement is bigger than ever. You know, young women to declare oneself a witch is incredibly popular among young women. Like it's almost mandatory in some, you know, certainly in Brooklyn or Los Angeles, you know, in big cities, things like this. And Parsons is talking about all this in The Witchcraft. It's like he's directly describing these things that have happened and that are happening. And it's for that reason that I think that Cameron is really the missing part of Parsons' story. And this is why I think that she needs more to get her full due. And I think that process has been ongoing. But it was so clear that they were just a phenomenally productive working partnership. I don't know how healthy their relationship was at a human level. Maybe not that healthy, but you know, what the Babylon working and is really just the beginning of that collaborative partnership, which I hope we find more and more out, more and more about. We find out more and more about that.
Yeah.
Right? So
no, I think that's it. They definitely acted as, you know, I mean, I think you're right. It was a kind of, they goaded each other into, you know, further pursuits into, you know, I think Cameron was somebody who could fully believe in what Parsons was doing and could totally back him up in her belief, because that's what Parsons needed, somebody to believe in him, really, in his workings. Equally, she could just leave him, you know, for 6 months and disappear and throw him into the pits of despair. But no, I think you're right. I mean, I know there was the book Wormwood Star was written about Cameron some time ago. But I think you're right. There's a growing, belief in seeing her as actually, complementary rather than subsidiary to kind of Parsons' story. And I think that's the more that comes out, the better it'll be for everything, for the story of Parsons and for the whole idea of the countercultural kind of magical movements in Los Angeles in the post-war years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important for people to understand that, just for people trying to understand magic at all, and because particularly with Crowley and Parsons really embody this kind of machismo alpha male, figure, the male potency. And what they missed, well, I don't think Parsons missed it. And I don't think Crowley fully missed it either, but Parsons was the first to really take it in the direction of understanding that. I think that if you just look at history, or if you look at, places like Tibet or countries that have, or parts of the world that have taken magic more seriously, you see that magic is often done by male-female partnerships. I think a good historical example would be Padmasambhava and Yeshe Sogyal, who brought Buddhism to Tibet from India. And it's a really important point that I think people need to realize, that in many ways, the female side of the equation is the source of inspiration and in many cases the source of the power. And I'm kind of getting off into the weeds here, but I think it's an important point for people to realize. And Parsons' life makes a good study of that.
Yeah, well, Parsons, always said that his greatest achievement was the Book of Babylon, which is, ushering in the age of the woman. So I think, he would agree with that too.
Yeah, I mean, you look at these Tibetan thangkas and mandalas and things like that, where it's always the male and female in Congress together. And of course, mm-hmm. Parsons was interested in sex magic and was immersed in that type of thinking. But anyways, yeah. I just feel it's an important point for my own sake to put in there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's funny that, it's funny that one could discuss sex magic without thinking that, both partners aren't equally important to the role of sex magic. I think it's, it would be like, you can't deny it once sex magic is involved,
Have you read, have you read Crowley's sex magic diaries and his records of doing that stuff?
I did. I read them back at the Warburg Institute in London, I think, back when I was researching the book. If they're the ones you're talking about.
Probably.
There was definitely quite a few of them. I can't bring them to my mind, at the moment. I believe so. like I say, it's been a while.
I think there are the records where when he first got into sex magic, he was living in New York and he was going to prostitutes and, one after the other, night after night. And, mm-hmm. With this kind of almost sociopathic clinical attitude towards things. It makes a fascinating study. How much things have, certainly how much social attitudes have changed.
Right. Yeah.
So with that said, I mean, we're kind of touching on Parsons and Cameron's intellectual contributions. What do you think the parts of Parsons' work that are most resonant to the modern world are now? What can we, as people living in 2018, go back to and learn from Parsons? What's most pressing and most relevant to us right now?
I guess it's, it's what I said about him, kind of the individual. We all like to think of ourselves as individuals, yet we often don't act as great individuals. We follow the herd. And I think maybe it's that, the idea of this man standing up. I mean, you have the whole story, which is how I told it in the book, is really him against, the world, him against the universe, he would have seen it as one man standing true to his belief, both in rocketry and in magic. And I think that idea, even though Parsons doesn't necessarily end with a kind of a terribly, good ending for those wanting to base their lives on Parsons, I think there's something about him in which he's, he embodies this age of freedom, this willingness to kind of to explore both in the occult world or in the rocket world, in the scientific world. outside of these giant systems of control, which I mentioned. You know, I think that's something we can take from Parsons. I mean, other than the fact that it's a very interesting life.
Yeah, it's fascinating also to read his book Freedom as a Two-Edged Sword and just his total attack on the servility and conformity of American society. And that also could have been written now, you know, certainly the Trump era.
so much like that. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, it's such a strange book, Freedom as a Two-Edged Sword. If anybody has a chance to read it, you should, because it's part libertarian kind of, you know, tryst against the kind of deep state, really. I mean, this was the time he was being investigated by the FBI. He was worried that people were spying on him. And yet it's also a magical treatise as well, you know, so you have, we must overthrow the state because, not because, you know, the state has got bugs in my bedroom and is listening to me, but because it's the age of Babylon, you know, he combines libertarianism with his kind of Babylon prophecy in a really interesting way. But yeah, no, it's definitely an essay for the times. Even if most people don't think that Babylon is the answer, it's railing against the state is really fascinating. I mean, it's really right up there with some great libertarian work.
Hmm. Well, who do you think? Well, I have a two-part question, and one is, Parsons seems like such an anomaly at the time, but I'm curious if you think he had any peers at the time. And one person that I'm thinking of is, recently I was reading the documents of the people who worked on the Manhattan Project, and one of the things that I came across was that Oppenheimer was obsessed with Eastern mysticism. Of course, there's the famous speech of "I am become death, destroyer of worlds," but it wasn't just a throwaway line. He was fully immersed in the ideas of yoga and meditation and higher consciousness and Eastern mysticism and the Hindu gods and mythology and all of this. And I'm kind of wondering, I guess my question isn't really, did Parsons have any contemporaries, but is this a running theme in history? Is there a lot more overlap between science and perhaps the worlds of religion or magic or whatever you want to call it, mysticism, than we might like to think? Are the lines not so cut and dry?
Yeah, no, I think absolutely they're not so cut and dry. I mean, I saw Parsons very much as kind of the last of the alchemists. And I mean that, you know, stretching back to Newton, you know, people who could combine, who could hold in their hand, you know, science, modern science, and, you know, occult knowledge. You know, most people forget that about 50% of Isaac Newton's writings were about alchemy. You know, and we don't really remember that 50%, but we remember everything else. And, you know, Parsons really was this, I think it was also, he was known as like the natural historian before the term scientist came up. I feel like Parsons really kind of straddles, you know, he's the last person before it became much harder to be like that. You know, that's not to say like scientists around his time weren't also interested in weird stuff and aren't still today. I mean, you know, while Parsons was living in Pasadena, Einstein was there. He went to a seance. He was kind of vaguely interested in telepathy. You know, lots of the scientists kind of were interested at the time. It just seemed to be the 30s in LA was definitely a time when these worlds were kind of colliding together. But maybe it ends up being in something like a kind of, you know, almost like the planets in the solar system. Like the worlds get close together and then they go apart again for a while. And then they get close together and they go apart again. It feels like at Parsons' time, the worlds of mysticism and science were very close together. And now they seem to be further apart. Now it would be hard for somebody like, you know, Oppenheimer, a serious scientist, you know, imagine who would be the equivalent. Who's the most popular scientist at the moment? What's his name?
Popular. I mean, well, there's certainly, well, for science educators or popularizers, there's Neil deGrasse Tyson. And then for engineers, maybe maybe Elon Musk.
Right.
But just pure scientist, I'm not sure actually.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, if you take Neil deGrasse Tyson or Elon Musk, imagine if they were suddenly, you know, pushing, you know, saying, I am interested in, you know, in spiritualism. I'm interested in, you know, occult rites. I'm, you know, even if they interested, if they said they're interested in Eastern mysticism, they'd still be viewed with kind of, you know, suspicion. Whereas I think at the time that Oppenheimer was doing it, it was very much seen as a why not? We're trying to learn as much as we can. It was a much more holistic kind of education. And now I think there's such specificity within the scientific world that you can't allow yourself to be seen as anything other than just laser pointed on a single, you know, a single thing to study.
That's a real tragedy, isn't it? I mean, just because the human, you know, human curiosity is Catholic in the true sense of the word. I mean, people who are true geniuses are not specialists. They don't focus themselves only to one area of study because they're naturally curious. I think Parsons really embodies that.
No, but very much so. And I think, you know, in a strange way, science, despite its increasing specialization, like you try and understand string theory and so on, and it's almost impossible because people have thought about it so much. Yet science, despite itself, kind of prevents absolute knowledge. You know, you look deeper and deeper and you go from string theory into quarks and you go into, you know, multi-dimensional scientific understandings of the universe. And every time we think we've nailed it down, it spreads out and it dissipates and it kind of forbids us to be kind of laser focused on one thing because everything we look at opens up new worlds or new possibilities. And I think that's kind of, I think Parsons understood that. That's why he always held rocketry and science and magic together as a whole, because he realized there are more ways to break free of the world than just through a rocket ship. You know, there are many more ways.
Absolutely.
So I think it's an interesting time now, although it's harder to see those characters, you know, existing today. I think science by its very nature is going to forbid final answers. And that will, I think, hopefully engender a whole new generation to look more broadly and look more widely at the world.
I think it's happening. And I mean, one thing I've always told people is that as human beings and as a human species, we should be concerned with exploring outer space and inner space. And I think that's really what Parsons was up to. But even with Elon Musk, we shouldn't speak too soon. As you may have seen, Elon Musk just recently began dating Grimes, who is a young musician who's really into witchcraft. And she's also tweeted out she's a big fan of a book I edited with Genesis Peorage called The Psychic Bible, which is this massive 600-page book of occult writing from the 80s. So you never know what might happen to Elon. He might just stumble down a rabbit hole.
There's driverless cars. Who know that they'll take everybody to a certain place and something incredible will happen. You know, I think that's really interesting. Yeah, especially as we give away our autonomy, you know, to our technology. Where will it lead us?
That's the big question. Well, George, it was awesome to talk to you. Where can people find you online, and are there projects that they should be aware of?
So you can find me online at my website, which is just georgependle.com. I'm on Twitter if you want to tweet me. I'm always happy for a tweet. And you know, the book's still available on Amazon. Enjoy.
Yeah, book is Strange Angel, and the show is running on CBS All Access right now. And I hope it does get 5 seasons. How crazy would that be for the cultural impact?
I think it would be quite very interesting to have an entire, you know, 50-episode TV show dedicated to a scientist, occultist of Parsons' stature. I just think having it out there would just mean I'd feel a little bit better about civilization.
Right. Well, George, thank you so much for being on the show, and thank you again. And I will talk to you later.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. Hope you really, really enjoyed that. For more on Parsons and his occult work, definitely pick up my new book, John Dee and the Empire of Angels, right now. It's available on Amazon, wherever books are sold, or at johndee007.com. Okay, lots of love. I honor you, and see you next week.